in verse 8, in the great city which is mystically called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. So which city is that? Jerusalem, which is spiritually called, figuratively called Sodom. Why? Because it's in just like Sodom at that point of the story, isn't it? Or Egypt, which is the symbol of chaos, you know, and confusion. So figuratively, you could say that, you know, New York is a real Babylon or something like that. Figuratively speaking, it isn't Babylon, but, I mean, literally speaking, it isn't Babylon, but figuratively speaking, Jerusalem is called by an evil name here, where our Lord was crucified. That has to be Jerusalem. And their dead bodies will lie in the street of this city, in verse 8, and those from the peoples and tribes and tongues and nations will look at their dead bodies for 3.5 days, and those who dwell on the earth will rejoice and make merry. Chuck Swindoll says there's going to be a happy two witnesses day, where you give each other presents to celebrate the death of these wretched prophets who are telling the world they're wrong. Prophets always get put to death because people don't want to be told they're wrong. And so these men who are opposing the beast and his wicked power and warning them are going to be slaughtered, martyred, right? And there'll be great rejoicing across the world when we get rid of these two men. That's the point here. But after 3.5 days, what happens? Their bodies are caught up. And I suppose that is the rapture and the resurrection event there. They're caught up to meet the Lord in the air. So they're resurrected. So you don't need to fear those who can kill the body, Jesus said. The only one you need to fear is the one who can destroy your inner personality, the real you. Nobody can destroy that. Your belief and your character, they can shoot you to death. But that's not the one to be afraid of. Because these two witnesses are raised from the dead, even though they're put to death before. Then there's a great earthquake, and we have this famous passage in 15 through 18. We have the seventh angel sounding, the kingdom of God changes hands, and the resurrection occurs. 15 through 18. Chapter 12. The conflict between the faithful woman and the evil power. Now you've heard of the seed of the woman from Genesis onwards. Isn't there a conflict between the seed of the woman and the seed of the devil, the opposite power? There's an age-long conflict between God's people and the satanic people, so to speak. So what you have here is the woman. I would say the woman is the faithful, is the symbol for the faithful community throughout the ages. The faithful community that bore Messiah, who's that? Mary and her friends? Little remnant of faithful Israelites, weren't they? But you are part of that seed now. If you are Christ, then you're seed of Abraham, aren't you? Aren't you seed of the woman? So the Gentiles are included in God's faithful people. That's the beauty, Paul says, of being a Gentile Christian. So I would take this to be a symbol of the whole of the faithful community. And it produces the Messiah, look. But there's another sign in verse 3. We didn't read where it produces the Messiah, but we find that in verse 2. She was with child, and she cried out, being in labor and in pain to give birth. And another sign, now here's the counterpart to this good sign. Another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon having what? 7 heads and 10 horns. This is most important to get hold of this. The dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns. And his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven, threw them to the earth, and so on. And what he's trying to do in verse 4 is to devour the woman who bears the Messiah, the child. Now, since you're part of the messianic group, you can apply this to you also. Satan is trying to devour the faithful community. Satan, the power of evil, the dragon, whatever you like to call it, tried to devour Messiah, didn't he? What happened? Didn't they flee to Egypt? Didn't Herod say, "Where's the Messiah going to be born so I can go and worship him? Ha, ha, ha." You know, and exterminate him. So these are two powers in conflict. Now notice carefully what the woman does in verse 6. The woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God so that there she might be nourished. For how long? 1,060 days. That sounds very much like the same period of time here. The 3.5 years, you see? I think one key to all this is to bring all of these time periods together. They're the same. We read in Daniel of 1290 days. We just read of 42 months. We've read of 1260 days. They all seem to apply to the same period of agony, the rule of the beast power in the very last days before the kingdom is established. So here then you have faithful people who are protected by being taken to the wilderness. Now you may want to read that literally. Again, are we talking about people who are in the area of Judea? Didn't Jesus say, when you see the abomination of desolation, flee to the wilderness? Is this the same thing here? You have Judean Christians. It doesn't say what Americans should do, by the way. It says those who are in Judea should flee. Maybe this is it here, that somehow in the wilderness these people who are sealed will be protected from this time of tribulation. Now, there we need to correct though slightly, because we did say earlier that you're sealed against the wrath of God, but you're going to have to be alive during the tribulation period. But there's another twist in the argument. There's certainly evidence that certain parts of the church will be protected. I think not by being taken off the earth, but by being taken to a place in the wilderness, perhaps. Isn't that what Jesus said? He said, when you see the abomination of desolation, the faithful in Judea should flee. He didn't say, I'm going to come and resurrect you all and take you to heaven. He assumes that they're going to flee and be on the earth, but in a place of protection. There's a text in Isaiah, is it 26th chapter, I think, where he says, come my people and enter into your closets during the time of agony. There's protection for God's people. Luke says that some of you are going to be martyred in this time. Some of the church has to be in the thick of it. Maybe because they're Laodiceans and they have to prove their faith, you know, in the time of tribulation. Others, though, will be protected. I mean, all of that is here in this chapter. And you'll find then that this serpent, who is identified with the devil in verse 9, that the ancient dragon, the ancient serpent who deceived the entire world, or deceives the entire world, is at war with these faithful people. And verse 12 is interesting. This reason, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you having great wrath, knowing that he only has a short time. Now, I think that's a reference to the future. There's a time coming where Satan, however you construe that word, who is presently the god of the atmosphere, is going to actually come down and create havoc through this Antichrist. And that's what's being pictured here. Satan is being moved out of heaven, so to speak, down to the earth. And that's what's described in these verses. And when the dragon, verse 13, saw that he was thrown down to the earth, what did he do? He persecuted the woman, you see, in a last, final, last-ditch attempt to destroy the faithful people. And two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman. You have a type of this in Deuteronomy, where God bore the people of Israel on eagle's wings, remember? Figuratively speaking, he protected them. And what do? They flee to the wilderness, or fly to the wilderness in verse 14, where they're nourished for a time, times and half a time. That sounds very much like that same period of time, 3.5 years. If we take time to be a symbol for a year, then you have time, 2 times and half a time, 3.5 years. So during this period, apparently then, you have protection for this section of the church. But now notice what happens. Satan, in verse 15, the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman. He's trying to destroy the faithful people so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. But the earth helped the woman, notice. Not by being taken to heaven, as in a pre-tribulation rapture theory, which is very difficult to base on any of this. The faithful are seen to be on the earth. The earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth, drank up the river which the dragon poured out. In other words, the dragon's effort is thwarted in some way. And so when that happens, the dragon is enraged with the woman and goes off to make war with the rest of her offspring. Here you have then the two types in the church. You have one group of the church which is protected, apparently, and there are others of the faithful people who are left in the thick of it, and Satan goes after them then, you see. So you get the feeling that there's a place of safety for some in that region, perhaps, during that time. And that brings us then to a good place actually to stop, since 12 o'clock, because now we get to the beast, and it begins to really hot up, the story does, 13 and 14 and so on to the end. So we'll try to deal with that with the rest of our time, and we'll start the afternoon by playing another chapter for you from the tape so that you get into the mood again, and we'll try to tackle the rest of it.
Thank you very much, Anthony, and we appreciate your staying with us. We hope you can come back at 1 o'clock. Try to be here at 1, and we'll do our best to get started at 1. You're now on your own to find something to eat. Thank you.
Hey, we go to the neighbors.
Welcome back, everyone. Come in and have a seat. Make yourself comfortable. I'm surprised we are here just about at 1 o'clock, 1:01. Doing real good. Everybody went home and I'm sure had a nice dinner or whatever. And went out in the backyard and mowed the grass maybe and pulled dead tomato plants. I considered doing that. Anthony and I went out in our backyard and I found a few more tomatoes, actually. And he found some raspberries on the raspberry bush. Ate a few of those and gave a couple to Heather, his two-year-old. What does that have to do with Revelation? Not a thing. Glad to have you back, and Anthony, if you'll continue on.
Okay. Well, it's nice that you came back for the afternoon session. We're dealing with a very controversial book, a book that has caused a great deal of offense. Just before we start into the 13th chapter, I should mention to you that there are four methods of interpretation of this book. I wanted to put this on the tape. I've mentioned two of them already, and that is that there's the futuristic one, which is the one that we're pursuing, and that is that the book is basically a description of what happens just before the setting up of the kingdom. Now, to Church of God, Abrahamic faith people, the setting up of the kingdom is stuff that's in your blood, you know. But for many churchgoers, all of that is very obscure. They don't believe in that. But for you and me, we're convinced that Christ is coming back again, aren't we? But you see, many churches don't even teach that. Now, we're not here to bash churches. That's not the point at all. But it's an amazing thing that where I came from, the second coming is hardly mentioned. There was an interesting letter addressed to a magazine, I think a Presbyterian magazine, and the question was asked like this: why are there so few sermons in our churches on the second coming? Is this part of our belief or not? Said somebody in the Presbyterian church. And here's the answer. Not all Christians think alike on matters of theology, but it would be hard for someone to feel at home in our tradition who did not understand God as the one who has come, who is present, and who is yet to come, in whatever form the future winds up taking. To literalize the second coming is to ruin its beauty and significance. To ignore it is to avoid what may be the most important part of the gospel. We know about, since the past and present, relatively speaking, are brief, while tomorrow borders on forever. In a subsequent issue of the magazine, a reader responded to that answer, right? Kind of a vague answer, wasn't it? Whatever form the future may take, and so on. This writer said, I compliment the Reverend Blank for his elusive answer, his vague reply, his elusive non-answer to what I'm sure was a serious question about the second coming. If I understand his answer correctly, he said, in effect, we don't all agree, but if you want to be comfortable in the UCC, that's the church group that they were part of, you will need to agree that Jesus is coming again, but not really. For if you actually believe in the second coming, you will ruin both its beauty and its significance. Yet you can't ignore it because it's in the future. And then the man says, why not give a simple answer? Why not admit that those who cannot receive the Bible literally must spiritualize it away? Spiritualize the second coming because it's too large a segment of the New Testament to be ignored, isn't it? About a third of the Bible, I reckon, deals with this whole issue of the kingdom and the prophecy. And if you ignore it, you're really ignoring Jesus. See, it's just wrong to say that Jesus just spoke about love. And he did talk about love. But he talked a great deal about the second coming and the events preceding. And he talked, as far as I'm concerned, the whole book of Revelation is from him. The title of the book is the Apocalypsis, the Revelation of Jesus Christ. Now that means his revelation, the one that he gave. It's his book. And that's why we're dealing with it today. And we hope that the Lord who's listening to this is pleased with our efforts at least to tackle the book. Whereas in many places, you know, the book is completely disregarded. It is a fact. But Jesus did say, you know, that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Now, the 24th chapter of Matthew is part of that word, the great Olivet Discourse. And he dealt with the framework, the backbone of all that material there. And I think we have to take it seriously. So perhaps we're reaching the age now where the eschatology, the study of end-time things, will get on the map, and I hope that our little group can make some contribution, you know, to the study of end-time events. Anyway, I mentioned to you the four types of interpretation. One is the futurist one that we just mentioned that we're dealing with. The other would be the historicist method of interpretation, and that basically says that the book of Revelation spans 1900 years since the time that John wrote, about 96 A.D., And so it's a description of world events, at least part of world events, for two millennia now. Now, that system would say that the Pope is very heavily mentioned in the book of Revelation, under the title the Beast, at least the Roman Catholic Church. Now, in order to get to that kind of a system, you have to do a little bit of mathematical jugglery, as far as I'm concerned. You've been reading and you've been seeing on the chart here the 3.5-year period that we found in Daniel, we found in Revelation. How are you going to turn that into long periods of time? Well, the historicists say that 3.5 years really means 1,260 years. Not 1,260 days, but 1,260 years. And then they have a system of trying to identify periods of papal authority, with the Pope ruling and reigning, you know, and being powerful, spanning a period of 1,260 years. The problem with that is that they all tend to disagree on where to fit that in history. You have umpteen different charts and systems to try to make that work. And I don't think the day-year theory is correct. That's what it's known as, the day equals a year theory. In other words, when you read days, 1,260 days, you really should understand that to be years. Now, that would put a very, very different picture on this whole thing, wouldn't it? If Jesus is describing a period of 1,260 years, our whole thing here is wrong. You know, it's just wrong. And I don't think that's going to work. Now, that's the second method. There are two others. One is called the preterist method of interpretation. And that says that John is only describing things in his time. You see, John had a vision, or he said he did, but really it wasn't much of a vision, because what he did was just to observe the political scene in his own time with the Roman Emperor and the Roman Empire. And he described for the Christians of those days what he saw going on, and he basically encourages them to hang into the end. You know, there's nothing to be taken literally here. It's just at least not taken literally in respect of the Second Coming, but just in terms of what he saw going on in his own day. That's called the preterist, or contemporary with John type of interpretation. So he doesn't see the future, really, beyond his own time at all. Now, you're not going to buy that one, because you believe the Second Coming is mentioned in this book, don't you? And that didn't happen when John was alive. And the fourth method of interpretation would be called the idealist one. Now, the idealist interpretation says that you have just general principles here, timeless principles of good versus evil, but nothing concrete in the way of history. In other words, there are no events that are actually solid historical events here, you see. Now, do you see what's happening here? It's as though somebody's taking a can of fog and a big paintbrush and plastering a whole lot of fog over the text, as far as I'm concerned. Now, there's a history to all of this. How did this happen? It has to do with the way you treat Old Testament prophecy. You know, we've said that this book is really just a conglomeration, a mosaic of Old Testament prophecy. Now, Old Testament prophecy has one thing in view. It says Israel is going to be punished and Israel is going to be restored. You check it out in the prophets. They all basically have two themes. God is going to arise, shake the earth, intervene, punish Israel and the nations, and establish his kingdom. The problem is that people don't believe that. And so what they've said is that, well, you shouldn't take that literally, you see. It's all figures of speech. It isn't to be taken literally. So I asked one of my professors when I was getting my degree fairly recently, what do you understand by hope? What are you hoping for? And she's a very learned lady, and a very good lady. And she said, hope for me is the presence of God. Well, that's true, I see what she's saying, but it's more than that, isn't it? I mean, that really implies that nothing is going to happen different. Things will just go on, you know, and we'll kind of get better and better. And if we work hard enough, we will create a perfect world. So for her, there is no question of a real event. She doesn't think of the Second Coming as an event in history as you do. And many people do not. They don't think that Christ will literally come through the sky and set up his kingdom on the earth. And that will account for the fact then that this whole book has got a kind of a stigma attached to it. They cannot believe that God would ever do something as violent as is depicted here. It all seems to be Jewish and earthly and physical. And we want spiritual things, you see? You see the language that's used here? Talk to us about spiritual things. Don't talk to me about plagues and setting up the kingdom and the nations being angry. Give me spiritual things. The thing is that in the Hebrew mind, it is spiritual to talk about the new kingdom. That's spiritual. The spiritual and the physical are blended. All of which is to say that something has happened to theology to get it off base, and that is what we would call Gnosticism in the second century. There's a mixture of philosophy that gets mixed up with the faith, a mixture of various philosophies that gets entangled with the true faith. And Gnosticism says, the body is evil, physical things are evil, And what we need to do is get our souls purified and go off to heaven. Now, you see, this book of Revelation doesn't do that, does it? Doesn't it say the kingdom is coming on the earth? And Gnosticism, which is a kind of philosophy from Plato and other strands of information, works against that. And so I would say that what happened in the second century was a huge departure from the original faith of, in Christ as Messiah and his kingdom, moving away into a kind of philosophical, so-called spiritual, mystical thing. And we've all of us suffered from that. And what we're trying to do is to get behind that and go back and see what this really means in its original context. Yes?
You mentioned a minute ago that you said you did not believe in the day, year interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Would you want to clarify that as regards mm-hmm. to 70 weeks?
Yeah.
Because yeah. you see it there, don't you?
I don't think you do, and that's a little bit of a technical thing there. Rex is asking about the day-year theory, the idea that when you read 1260 days, you should call that 1260 years, which puts a whole new picture on the whole thing. And the argument is that in Daniel 9, where you have 70 weeks, you know the 70 weeks prophecy, that is to be read as 490 years. And that's the way it's traditionally expounded. And that is probably right. The 70 weeks there are equivalent to 490 years. Now, you did multiply by 360 there, didn't you, to come to that? If you go from 70 weeks to 490 years, I'm not good at math, but you'll see that that is so. You've actually applied a year for a day. Okay, there's a problem with that, though, because if you look at your NIV translation, you'll find it says 70 sevens. It doesn't say 70 weeks. The word in the Hebrew there is an ambiguous word. It means a unit of seven. It could be 7 days, 7 years, 700 years. Now, if the word actually meant week, and only meant week, then you could argue that there's a day-year theory working there. But since the word is not clear, it means a heptad, to use a technical term, a unit of seven. You don't know whether it's years or days. The only way we would know it's years there is because in the context, Daniel has been thinking about the 70 years of punishment that was on Israel. It was coming to an end at that time. And so years are in that context. So it's proper to interpret the 77s as sevens of years, not because a day-year theory is working, but because that word seven is ambiguous, I think. You see, that would be the counter-argument there. However, if that seems complicated, what would you do? Supposing the day-year theory is supposed to work. Every time you come to a day in prophecy, you're supposed to read years. Well, what would that do? Jesus said, as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the grave. Does that mean then 3 years? One would think not. What about the fact that Nebuchadnezzar had a period of madness imposed upon him for a time, time and half a time? That's 3.5 years, presumably. Is that supposed to be 1260 years? It's questionable. What about when Jonah went to Nineveh and he was told within 40 days Nineveh's going to fall? Was that supposed to be 40 years? You see, you run into problems here. Some kind of consistency will have to work. And so most expositors have given up the day-year theory as a failure. It doesn't really cohere. Even within the book of Daniel, it doesn't fully seem to work. But you'll find the NIV version there in Daniel 9 says 70 sevens have been measured out. That's an ambiguous term. It doesn't say 70 weeks. It could be just any kind of unit of seven. Glad you raised that, though. That seems to me the way to go. There's another way of getting at that, though, that might be interesting to think about. We read in Daniel 11, you remember, where in the 31st verse it says that the abomination of desolation will be set up. Remember that text? And then at the end of the vision it says there'll be 1,290 days from the abomination being set up to the end, right, to the very final end. Now, you'll find if you read the vision that it concerns the career of one person. Let's just look at that moment. It just occurs to me this is a way of establishing the time period here. But in Daniel 11, this is such an important section of Scripture, by the way, for prophecy, that it's well worth looking at. Daniel 11, and I'll make some of the points that we made before just to reinforce this. Daniel 11, verse 31, you have this statement about the abomination of desolation that Jesus said will initiate the Great Tribulation. If you follow the story down there, you'll find that one individual is in the story. Verse 32, by smooth words he will turn to godliness. He, right, this individual, this king of the north. Verse 33, those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many. It's almost as though a few people at that time, in the tribulation time, will know what's going on, and they will be high premium people at that point. They'll be very valuable because they'll be able to know what's happening. And then it says that some of them in verse 35 some of those who have insight will fall to be refined until the end time. And now we come to verse 36, the king. Now the king, friends, is the same he that we've had in this story. It has to be. Normally when you say the king, you're referring back to somebody already mentioned, aren't you? You don't bring in somebody brand new. It doesn't make any sense to introduce somebody new there. The king is simply the king of the north, who's been the king of the north throughout this chapter. Right? The king of the north and the king of the south. From verse 21 onwards, it's the same king. You can check that. You have to read this very slowly and thoughtfully sometimes, this whole chapter 11. And look at 21 onwards, you'll find it's a single king of the north who is dominant there. In verse 36, he comes doing some awful things. The king, verse 36, will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished. Now that text is quoted in 2 Thessalonians 2 by Paul of the man of sin. In other words, when Paul thinks of the man of sin or the Antichrist, he pulls this verse out of Daniel, and I think that's why. It's right, because that is the Antichrist, you see. Which is simply to say that all of this Antichrist beast material is drawn from the book of Daniel. Jesus did not invent this. He commented on something that was already there. Problem is that people don't know the book of Daniel well these days. But if you've been brought up, you know, sitting on Mary's knee, having this stuff read to you maybe, if that's in your blood, then it's very clear what's being spoken of. The king is the king of the north. You run the story down to the end of the chapter, and you'll find that in verse 45, and this is good we raised this because it leads on to what we're going to do with the beast in a moment. It says, 45, he, the same king of the north, will pitch his tents, or the tents of his royal pavilion, between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain, yet he'll come to his end, and nobody will help him. And remember, there are no chapter breaks in the original Bible. You read right on into chapter 12. What does it say then? At that time, Michael, the great prince, who stands over the sons of your people, will arise, and there'll be a time of distress such as there's never been and never will be again. Now, Jesus referred to that, do you remember, in Matthew 24? As the Great Tribulation, didn't he? You see what Jesus is doing? He's simply pulling verses from Daniel 11 to describe the events of the end. That's exactly what Daniel was talking about. It fits beautifully. It all harmonizes. And in verse 2 of chapter 12, you have this beautiful resurrection statement. Many of those who are sleeping in the dust of the ground. That tells you what they're doing, sleeping. And it tells you where they're doing it. In the ground, isn't it? Many of those who are up to that point have been sleeping in the dust of the earth will arise in resurrection, some to everlasting life. And let me tell you a little secret about the original language. The term everlasting life means life in the coming age of the kingdom. That's well known. Our translations are influenced by Platonic thinking. Everlasting life, it is everlasting life, you know, but that's more of a vague idea. It's just sort of endless life. Now, you're going to have endless life, that's true. If you're immortal, you can't die. But the expression here, everlasting life, is more of a technical expression that every Jew understood, or every religious Jew did. It means life in the coming age of the kingdom. You see the two ages? We're living in the present evil age, but there's going to be the age of the coming kingdom, and we're trying to gain life in the coming age of the kingdom. So your famous text about John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have life in the coming age of the kingdom. You see, everlasting life, eternal life, really means life in the coming age. And that's what these people get. Now, as you go on through the story then, down in verse 11, we mentioned it before, chapter 12, verse 11 of Daniel, it says, from the time the abomination is set up until the end will be 1290 days. Now, I would argue that has to be 1290 days, not years, because you only have the career of one person from 31 onwards. In other words, you can't spread that over 1290 years, because there's only one pronoun. He does this, and he, and he, and he. It's an awfully long-lived individual who managed to survive 1,290 years, you see. You see the point? This passage is so important, this Daniel 11. It's the key to a great deal of prophecy. Anyway, that is the beast, I would argue, that turns up then in the book of Revelation. That character, that last king of the north, is the beast power. And he emerges then in Revelation chapter 13, where we've now got to. Chapter 13. Now these are so-called interlude chapters, again, in the sense that they take up other themes. The chronology doesn't move on here. We're not moving through the seals and the trumpets and the plagues yet. We haven't got to the plagues, but we're taking up various themes. And so we have a beast who is mentioned here, And I think I will invite you to listen to this on the dramatized version, just this 13th chapter, to get you back in the mood, so to speak. See what we make of this 13th chapter.
And I saw a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on his horns, and on each head a blasphemous name. The beast I saw resembled a leopard, but had feet like those of a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power and his throne and great authority. One of the heads of the beast seemed to have had a fatal wound, but the fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was astonished and followed the beast. Men worshipped the dragon because he had given authority to the beast. And they also worshipped the beast and asked,
"Who is like the beast? Who can make war against him?"
The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies and to exercise his authority for 42 months. He opened his mouth to blaspheme God and to slander his name and his dwelling place and those who live in heaven. He was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. And he was given authority over every tribe, people, language, and nation. All inhabitants of the earth will worship the beast, all whose names have not been written in the book of life belonging to the Lamb that was slain from the creation of the world. He who has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to go into captivity he will go. If anyone is to be killed with the sword he will be killed. This calls for patient endurance and faithfulness on the part of the saints. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He exercised all the authority of the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. And he performed great and miraculous signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in full view of men. Because of the signs he was given power to do on behalf of the first beast, he deceived the inhabitants of the earth. He ordered them to set up an image in honor of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. He was given power to give breath to the image of the first beast, so that it could speak and cause all who refused to worship the image to be killed. He also forced everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of his name. This calls for wisdom. If anyone has insight, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it is man's number. His number is 666.
It's kind of a threatening chapter, isn't it? Now, this is where much of the interest, I suppose, has focused on this beast. Again, you have to remember that Daniel, the book of Daniel, is behind this material. What Jesus is doing here in terms of this beast that's described as looking like a bear and a lion and a leopard is taken straight out of the 7th chapter of Daniel. And it seems to be a composite of those beasts that are listed in Daniel 7. There was a conglomeration of all the worst qualities of the beasts described in Daniel 7 are coming together in a final political configuration. The beast, well, he arises from the sea. Maybe from the Mediterranean, because in the Daniel version it says from the Great Sea, and the Great Sea is the normal biblical expression for the Mediterranean, possibly, if we take the word sea literally. In many cases, it's difficult to know whether to take this symbolically or literally. That's the constant difficulty with the book of Revelation. But anyway, he rises from the sea. He resembles the dragon. Now, the dragon is said to be the devil. He has all the qualities of the devil. Just as Jesus reflects the quality of his Father, Jesus has the value of God, somebody has said. Doesn't he? Has the value of God. He's not God, but he has the value of God. He fully expresses the character of God. So this person, this beast, this Antichrist, fully reflects the quality and the character of Satan, who is his master. There's a counterpart there. He has composite animal features. He's empowered by the dragon. That reminds us of 2 Thessalonians 2. That's the other chapter you should be aware of, where Paul says that this man of sin is going to work according to the energy of Satan, with all lying miracles and signs and wonders. It's the same idea here, then. He's empowered by the dragon. Now, he has one head, wounded to death, but is healed in verse 3 and 4. Here, we're looking at the qualities of the beast here. And a very interesting factor in his description is the fact that he has one head, wounded to death, but healed. So this beast, then, has 7 heads and 10 horns. But one of the heads is particularly significant, because it's wounded in some way, to death, and yet revived. Now, you have to let your imagination run a little bit here. What seems to be implied is that an individual is spectacularly revived in some way. I mean, this is one possibility. I'm not going to attempt to dogmatize here, I don't know. But you get the feeling that some apparent death will occur to an individual, and he'll be revived in some marvelous way, and the whole world will be amazed at this. Now, I'm aware of the historicizing interpretations which would say that we're talking about the Roman Empire here, and the Roman Empire fell and was revived. I'm aware of that. It seems to me that doesn't quite meet the case, because the attempts to interpret this in terms of Roman emperors is very shaky. Nobody can quite agree which emperor is head number 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. It doesn't seem to work. And I think we're talking about something in the future anyway, and so I'm not going to attempt to identify any of this with something that's already happened. But one of the heads is wounded and comes to life. He then blasphemes God and God's people for 42 months. There's that period of 3.5 years again. Isn't that interesting? The period, apparently, of the Great Tribulation. He makes war against the saints and kills some of them, at least. He gives to those who follow him his mark, which is either his name, or his number, which is 666. The intensity of 6. Now, 6 is the number of man. That man was created on the 6th day. 6 is short of the perfection of 7, isn't it? It's inadequacy somehow. When you multiply it 3 times, you go 666, that's intense imperfection. That's the number of the Antichrist. Now, the number of Jesus in Greek, Jesus is the Greek for Jesus, is 888, would you believe it? Now, 8 is 1 over 7. It's superabundance. And so somehow, names have numerical value. The Jews call that the study of gematria, G-E-M-A-T-R-I-A. It's the science of counting names. Now, we don't do that in English. But you could take your name and say A is 1, B is 2, and assess the value of your name. Wouldn't do you any good, probably. But the number of the beast is 666. Now, people have sometimes translated that by rendering it, I think the tape did this, this is the number of man. It doesn't mean the number of a man, but it's the number of man. And that's possible, but more likely it means it is actually the number of a man, a particular man. In which case, then, one would think that in the Greek language, you assess the name of a candidate for the beast, and you would find that it comes up to 666. And I don't think any of us knows who that is. And I resist attempts to identify Sadat, as he's now dead, but Sadat has been the Antichrist, and Khrushchev was the Antichrist, and Gorbachev has been the Antichrist till he turned out to be a good boy, and now he's no longer the Antichrist. You see, unfortunately, the study of prophecy has been blighted, in my opinion, by a lot of sensationalist writers who have really spoiled it for everybody. I mean, they've been shouting Second Coming, you know, and this is the beast, and it's the Antichrist, and the computer, 666, and I don't think that helps us. It's better to wait until these events really do happen. So a lot of our folk out here are going to say, what nonsense this is. You know, every time they have a political upheaval, all these stupid Christians run around with their Bibles saying this is the Antichrist. But if this stuff means anything at all, one day it's going to come true. And so I think we need to be rather conservative. Let's not say that Christ is coming tomorrow. I doubt that very much. We should always be prepared. But also we should take a sober look at what Jesus actually predicted rather than making up our own version of it. Anyway, this beast is interesting because along with him, he has a false prophet. Now, I mentioned before, we might call him the minister of propaganda of the beast. He's an agent who goes around gaining support for the beast, isn't he? That's what it says down here. But notice what the second beast is like in verse 11. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb. Now, he's a gentle fella. Two horns like a lamb. He comes as a nice guy, apparently. Didn't Jesus speak of wolves in sheep's clothing? Beware of false prophets, he says. Many will say in that day, didn't we do this, that, and the other, only to be told that they were false prophets. Narrow is the way that leads to the life in the kingdom. Why? Because of all the false prophets. If you read the gist of the Sermon on the Mount there, the implication is that the difficulty for Christians is the fact that there's so much confusion and false teaching around that it's hard for the Christian to get on the right track. So this is the supreme false prophet. He's backing the beast and attracting attention to the beast. He seems to have miraculous powers, calling down fire from heaven. He's playing God, because in Acts 2, fire came from heaven in a sense, didn't it? At the day of Pentecost, wasn't there a heavenly visitation there in the form of fire? Well, this fellow's going to do the same thing. And it reminds us then of the time in Pharaoh's kingdom, where Moses, you know, was being rivaled by Pharaoh's magicians. So Satan, however you construe that term, has enormous power and should not be underestimated to do miracles. And Jesus said that many false prophets will be on the rampage in the tribulation period, causing signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. This is the same theme going here.
Where would you place Revelation 13, these events that are being described there, in connection with the seals of trumpets?
Well, we're back in what I would call the fifth seal. You remember the fifth seal, if we followed the comparison between Matthew 24 and Revelation, then the fifth seal would be the Great Tribulation period. And I think probably this is a kind of a glance back at that. The reason for saying that is that we're dealing with 42 months here. Seems to be the period of 3.5 years. So we're looking at the events of the tribulation. Yeah, Notre Dame did make some remarkable prophecies. I don't think I have the authority or knowledge to answer that. I mean, he apparently did predict some things remarkably. It's awful to make judgments. I don't know. I'll kind of reserve an answer. I don't know. What do you think? It's a hard question to answer. I would hate to label somebody, you know, individually as a false prophet, because one is never sure, but not sure. Did he? Okay, if our scheme of prophecy is right, that's not going to happen. Now, here we're getting onto very sensitive ground, because, you know, there is a school that has the pre-tribulation rapture in it, which says, and this is out of Dallas Theological College, is one of the main areas where they're teaching that, that theory says that Jesus could come today and take the saints away, and then the tribulation would begin. The theory that I'm working out denies that. I have to step...